are listening to Thinkative.
You are.
The podcast for philosophers, seekers,
and the generally curious.
And we are today in the hallowed halls of the LSE, the London School of Economics.
And political science.
And who'd have thought it? What are the chances?
What are the chances of that?
And luckily...
Very luckily.
We have someone who might be able to shed some light on that for us this evening. Because we have a philosopher of probability, a professor of
philosophy from University of Leuven in Belgium, Professor Sylvia Venmakers.
Yes. Marvelous.
Welcome.
Yeah, I feel very welcome.
Thank you so much for coming. It's brilliant. We can't get over it. A guest as well on this. And you've bought a really, before we get into the probability, yes. We get to the important part of the evening, which is the wine.
Yes, and I brought it from Belgium, and even there you cannot just buy it in any shop. I went to the person who made the wine. So in Belgium there used to be some wine made of grapes until I think the 1800s. But this is a person who started making wine from apples in 1978. And later on, you also included grapes. So this is a wine, both apples and grapes, made in Belgium, and very nice.
Excellent. Wow. Yeah, do you want to pour? Will you do the honors?
It would be nice if you do
okay.
it.
Okay, I'll pour.
Oh, thanks, Matt.
You have more moving. It's
the first time we've had non-alcoholic wine before, but we've never had...
It's alcohol.
Alcohol, great.
I've never had apple wine, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
so pass them around.
Okay.
Oh, cheers. Thanks very much.
So while I'm pouring, I'll just say that,
thank you.
Sylvia is here for a LSE... philosophy department graduate student conference on the philosophy of probability. Mm-hmm. And Sylvia and I met at the same conference 7 years ago, and I was a commentator on her paper about infinitely small probabilities. Mm. And we've been arguing about it ever since.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I want to... We have touched... I'm just going to move that there we're not blocking anybody. Important. But, I'd love to know a bit about it, because we have touched on probability before, but, yeah, before
Maybe
we do that...
Taste,
yeah.
Huh?
What's the... What's Belgium for cheers?
Cheers.
Gezondheid.
What?
To your health. Gezondheid.
Gezondheid.
Gezondheid. Gezondheid. I like that.
Mm.
It's with apples, so it has to be healthy.
An apple a day.
Mm.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Yeah, but
that's
it is.
Very nice.
You are surprised, aren't you?
I'm really surprised how subtle it is, because you can taste the apple, I think, but it tastes like white wine. It doesn't taste like some kind of a fruit punch or something.
No.
Yeah.
So he tried many apples, and he picked this one because it leaves the least acid residue of the apple.
Wow, nice.
Well,
great.
So
that stunned us into silence, the apple one. But,
stunned us into silence. Gesundheit, isn't that the same thing you say when people sneeze? Or no?
Yeah, you can say the same thing. But the way you say it, it's almost like in German.
Oh, I see. That's the German.
Yeah, we say it Gesundheit.
Gesundheit. Well, Gesundheit to you, and welcome, and thank you for coming. And we can't wait to hear about more about probability. And how that works within the field of philosophy, really, because obviously we know about probability from basic maths when we were at school.
Playing
dice.
You know, what's the probability of a dice? You know, six turning up on a dice, 36, whatever, three dice, but 18. I don't know. Anyway, but what's interesting to me are all those other permutations of possibility and likelihood. And all those permutations of, you know, what are the chances? Coincidence.
Exactly.
Which
yeah,
is
that seems
to
be
to
quite
about.
A disconnection between what you learn in school, which is like basic counting problems, really, with all these dice and lotteries, and then we use the word probably this will happen, or we use variance that you, suggest it's about probability, where it isn't clear that we can count anything, really. So there is, and that is exactly what philosophy of probability is also about, like trying to clarify what do we mean by probability in all these various contexts. Right. So one context is betting and dice, but that's only one from a wide spectrum. For instance, you could bet on horse races.
Yeah.
But if you have then only had classes with dice and other games of chance, it seems that none of which you were taught applies there. Because what is going on in these betting contexts is that, well, you have to know a little bit about which horse is a good one and who is in the race. If you know absolutely nothing, it's a bit like betting on the throw of a die.
Yeah.
Because, well, any horse could win and you don't have any reason to prefer one over another one. But when you look at the betting odds, apparently people put a lot of money on some horses and not so much on the others. So apparently they know something. They know something that it's more likely, more probable that that horse will win. So that seems to be a context that is about probability, but not at all like casino games, for instance.
Right.
And then apart from that, so there it seems to have to do something with numbers because you are willing to bet some amounts of money, but not that much. Or so it is related to numbers. But there are also these cases where that doesn't seem, it's not so clear that it's about numbers. For instance, when we were gathering here before the podcast, so I was telling I was from Belgium, and Gavin, who is operating the camera, mentioned, oh, I've been in Belgium, in Ghent, to a concert of Leonard Cohen. And I said, oh, you've been in Ghent? So I lived there for a couple of years. And during the concert of Leonard Cohen, I went to the square where it was happening. It was a lovely summer evening. I didn't go to the concert, but I could hear it. Yeah. So we met in a way like we were very close in the same space.
You both heard the same sounds.
We heard the same sounds. We both appreciated the nice weather, the nice music. And now we meet here. And that is something that provokes the expression, like, what are the chances, right? So that suggests there
is the title.
A probability.
Yeah.
The chance or the probability of that happening. But if you ask, so that now the philosopher comes in and she will say, like, if you ask that question, like, what are the chances, you are presupposing that there is such a thing, that there is, that you could, if you just thought about it very deeply, you could put a number on how probable or how unlikely it is that that would happen. But in this case, actually, what we should keep in mind also is that, so I mentioned I'm from Belgium, and that is why this piece of information came to the front in the first place. Obviously, there's still a coincidence that he went to Ghent, but on the other hand, there are many more people that live in Ghent or that visit Ghent than any other place. So there is also this human tendency of the way we exchange information that sort of helps us find these patterns where people have been in the same place and it seems so unlikely. But on the other hand, the other view on this is, well, it would be very, very, very more unlikely that at no point in time such coincidences would happen. Given that there are so many people, they tend to cluster in cities and so on, it would be very unlikely that it would never happen that you have a guest that you, like, 3 out of 4 of you have never met. So we have met, and it was like a causal relation for us meeting. We have the same interest in a rather small academic niche, so it's a, it can be explained. But this is more like unexplainable. We had different reasons for going there. I lived there. Gavin decided to buy a ticket to watch Leonard Cohen. But it would be very strange if there never would be a thing happening like that with any of your guests. So that is like the other perspective that can make it less mysterious.
Yeah.
This what are the chances, coincidence, events?
Because there's also, I mean, that famously there's that the chance of meeting somebody who shares your birthday at a party.
The birthday paradox.
The birthday paradox, which always seems like really amazing when you meet somebody. Oh, my birthday's December the same as well, and so is yours. I remember that's happened to me once at a party, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. There's only like 30 people here.
Yeah.
What are the chances? But of course, the chances are actually, when you come down to it, quite high.
Yeah, this is a case where you can actually compute it. Like the chance meeting of people is hard to. How can you even start modeling it? Like, what is your probability of being in a particular city at a particular point in time? But with birthdays, you can simply assume, like, each day is about equally probable that a person is born on that day. It's not exactly that, but approximately. And then the room doesn't have to be that full to have more than half probability, so more than 50% probability that at least two people will have the same birthday.
Wow.
Because there are a lot of degrees of freedom, like who are the two peoples? There are a lot of combinations.
Yeah.
And then it's also not set up front which date is going to be. But obviously, if you are one of those persons, like that date, it's your birthday, it feels already kind of special.
Yeah.
So if somebody else matches it, it feels like super special.
Mm.
So it is still, like, from the personal perspective, it still is a coincidence.
This is that subjectivity of coincidence, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And our natural tendency to find patterns in things, where in what is, as far as I can see, as life has showed me, a stream of random, disconnected, chaotic events.
Well, I knew two twins, and they said, oh, I think we're a bit psychic. I said, well, why? Well, I'll give you this example. So, well, the other day, I was in the supermarket buying some cheese, and I thought, what's my twin brother doing? So I phoned him up, and he was in the supermarket buying some cheese.
Yeah.
What are the chances?
I'm like, every time you phone your brother up, every single time is he in the supermarket at the same time as you buying cheese? It's just a coincidence. And then you've just, like, taken that as, like, whoa, we're twins, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
We're psychically connected.
Yeah, there is a lot of selective memory going on in these cases. Like, if he would be doing something randomly, other than you wouldn't even remember it that well because it wouldn't have this meaning. But as soon as we perceive a certain pattern of two things being very close in time or at the same place or two people, then we tend to assign meaning to it.
Mm.
And obviously, there can be meaning. I mean, it can be that if you happen to see the same person a lot, that actually he or she is stalking you. I mean, that could be. That's one hypothesis. Another hypothesis is that, well, this is just one of those coincidences.
Mm.
Person has to be in the same shops or whatever. So it makes sense that we are sensitive to looking for these patterns, but that doesn't mean that it isn't to be expected that some of these chance events are actually due to chance. So
the weird thing would be if coincidences didn't occur.
Exactly. Yeah. That's like a lesson formulated like that really stuck with me. It was mentioned by David Hand, who was a statistician and wrote a book. It's called The Improbability Principle. I read it in Dutch, but the original title was that. And I think this is like the main lesson. Like, it would be much more improbable that never something seemingly improbable would happen.
Right.
Simply because so many things happen. There are so many people that could meet. And combined with the fact that we as humans tend to try to assign meaning to the patterns we perceive.
Mm.
And sometimes that's for a good reason. And I think that's mainly what science is about. It's about looking at patterns and then figuring out which are like the cases where there is more behind the pattern than things happening at the same time. And also, like, in these cases, I think what's also is going on is that there is a lot of tolerance and, like, what is close enough to be sort of, like, I wasn't at the Cohen concert. I was on the same square. So I could have been two streets away and I could have heard the music and I would still feel, obviously it gets weaker. But if you are going to get around, like, the vicinity of, like, the real hit, so to speak, the really being at the same place at the same time, the more you go around it, the more room there is for these events to happen, so to speak.
Mm.
So a lot of the coincidences can actually be deconstructed like this.
I think it's really interesting observation that these very unlikely events are very likely to happen, depending on how you sort of... How you conceive the reference frame, right?
Yeah.
So if you ask what are the chances that I and the cameraman from this particular podcast would be at the square in Kent on the same day at the same time.
Yeah,
that's very small.
Very small. Yeah.
If you ask, what are the chances that one of us in this group of five people were on the same square somewhere in the world at some time, it's really quite large. Of course, it's unusual that you actually, you know, hit upon the fact that you were both there.
But you find it out.
But that was aided by the fact that Leonard Cohen was there, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And also, though, like, so if you think about just a simple example of like throwing darts at a dartboard, right? Now you throw the dart at the dartboard. The dart hits a very specific spot on the dartboard, right? And the dart's very very narrow little shaft of metal, so it just makes a tiny hole. And now if you ask, well, what's the probability that the dart, what are the chances that the dart would have hit that exact hole? Well, it's very, 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 very small, right?
Yeah.
But it had to hit somewhere on the dartboard unless you're just a really crap dart thrower.
Really drunk,
right?
Yeah.
So as a, you know, as a consequence, extremely unlikely events happen all the time. All the time. Like with the lottery, what are the chances of winning the lottery? Nearly zero.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to win.
Yeah, if they are going to hold the lottery and like all the combinations are taking, then you know for sure, up in advance, it's certain that something improbable will happen.
Yeah, and then also, of course, when you do win it, you go, oh my God, and I wasn't going to do it that day. And do you know what? I changed the numbers. And everything, and so it becomes like, to again, we have that, we invest it with that personal significance, and a certain, there's that tendency to invest mysticism into very cool mathematical probability that we do, and I'm interested in why we do that. I mean,
why we invest mysticism into it?
Why we invest it with you know, because there's this sense of identity in the same ways we've covered. Probably rambling off at a tangent. We can reel it back in soon. But we put ourselves within this random chaotic universe and this life we live in. We like to think that there's some sort of order, don't we? And there's some sort of meaning.
It would be cool if there were.
If it were.
It would be exciting. And also it would be just kind of cool because, you know, it's within the realm of possibility that there are patterns within the apparent randomness of the world that we live in, right? So, you know, an omnipotent God could have set the initial conditions of the world in just such a way such that, you know, you would win the lottery and it was your destiny in principle, right?
Yeah.
Assuming that, you know, that the world is more or less deterministic. Yeah. And of course, that's an open question. But it's, you know, so it's intriguing to think that it looks like what's happening is random, but we don't know that really. There could be some kind of hidden order in the noisy events of everyday life.
Yeah,
and it's really appealing, right?
It also always strikes me when people are talking about coincidences, like outside of philosophical discussions about it, that it's almost like they cannot really decide on whether they are going to call it destiny or like complete coincidence. And I don't know if it's the same in English, like this word in Dutch for coincidence. It sometimes always also has this magical meaning, which actually means the opposite, like fate or...
Interesting.
So yeah. on the one hand, you can say like, I don't believe in coincidence. That would mean something like it has been fated. Somehow people believe that there is this plan.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, people who say very emotionally, like, I do believe in coincidence, it seems to mean the same thing. Like, they use the same word for the opposite meaning.
In a way, luck has the same kind of ambiguity, right? You could say, you know, I've got good luck today, which means there's some sort of force
there's
that is bringing good to you,
like,
right?
Yeah.
Or you could say, well, that was just luck, which means it was random. It was purely random.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's also interesting from more like a historical perspective on the theory of probability, so how to compute it, that probably at least there is one philosopher who wrote on the history of probability. His name is Ian Hacking, who sort of suggests that all these beliefs about God deciding our fate, the gods that decided how long the thread of life would be, that all these beliefs that things have been already determined sort of counteracted humans already developing probability theory, like the ancient Greece. And in ancient Greece, they could have dealt with these simple die testing problems. I mean, it's not that hard. It's not harder than the geometry that they actually developed.
It's one divided by six.
Yeah. They could have done it, but just the concept of there's being something like a random process or however you want to call it, that goes against the grain of thinking for a very, very long time. So it's also not that strange that we still can be confused about it.
Oh, that's really interesting thesis. I don't remember that, but so his claim is that the sort of ancient belief in purpose or teleology in the world, like, hid probability and the theory of probability, hid it from the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, that's what I took from.
Wow. Yeah.
No, it's good stuff, I think. But I mean, in terms of the use of probability and the purpose of studying probability. I mean, here's one. It's to kind of convince. Sometimes I grew up in a very superstitious household. So sometimes when we talk in this way, which is what, like, you know, and life has taught me that things don't work that way. Over time, sometimes I think, oh, it's a bit of a fun sponge, though, isn't it, really?
Because a fun sponge?
You know, because it's nice. It's nice.
Oh, right. It soaks up the fun.
Yeah,
right.
It soaks up the fun, you know.
Takes the fun out of it. Okay.
Not that thinking that, you know, that a guiding hand is there, but that is sort of inferred, is that there's a sort of, like karma, like anything, really, that there's a universal law which is in operation here, that we are being somehow monitored. Things are happening for our benefit. People fall in love. People.
Yeah, people think that they're destined for each other.
Yeah,
we met on the train, you know, and there was only one way, and she was going to be late that day, and we met on the train.
And what are the chances?
And what are the chances? And that's beautiful, and, you know, and that's a kind of lovely thing. And then people can go through their whole life thinking, oh, wow, that's been a magnificent thing to happen in my life. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for that, my life would be X, Y, or Z, you know. But I'm glad that it's turned into Z, and that's because of the wonderful coincidence of us getting on the train on the same day. And so there's a certain romanticism. What it does, it kind of, like, it takes the romanticism sometimes out of life.
Right. So the theory of probability, having a science of it, kind of sucks out all the fun and beauty.
Yeah. Sometimes I think it can. I think it can take away from the romanticism because you go, actually, no. You know what?
You're killing the destiny.
Yeah, you're killing the destiny. You know what? It was because I was really lonely. I wanted a relationship, and she wanted a relationship, and we both found ourselves on that train, and there was something about it. You know, and then you get sort of like quite deconstructed about it. Right. Whereas there's a certain romance, there's a certain energy in that romance, and there's a certain magic in the energy of it, which is sometimes I find, I go, oh, well, you know, the truth is, I know the truth. You know, for example, you talk about the I Ching, for example, the
Yijing, yeah.
Which is all about, well, the initial I Ching was not really that. It was used as a consultation book of wisdom, wasn't it? And you go, oh, well, certain factors arise within life, then these are the sort of symptoms that you will find. But then it got turned into an oracle. So people were using yarrow stalks initially, 6-4 yarrow stalks, which in a very complicated kind of probability counting system. And then that kind of got sort of eased up into like just throwing three coins and going heads, you know, it's a combination of three heads, which narrows that thing down. So then you go, oh, what's in store for me today? Life, throw it in here. You know, I did this for quite a while back in the 20th century.
Really?
And then, yeah. And then you sort of, then you start to have a look. And then eventually you go, this has got no meaning. Do you know what I mean? This is just anything.
Yeah.
But you can give it meaning. I mean,
but that's what I mean. You can supply meaning, like tarot cards, like anything. Again, taking a random and reading into the random.
Yeah. Tea leaves.
Meaning. And there's a
the
certain
clouds.
There's a certain allure there. There's a certain romanticism about that.
Right.
Which I kind of miss as I've grown through the understanding of what probability really is.
Well, actually, maybe if you looked at the history of probability theory again, so when it did develop originally, it would still have been compatible with the idea of a plan, really. Because if we... So Laplace, he wrote a treatise on probability, and then also like a more popular account. So he found it really important. Like one thing that was It's a bit a side note, but one thing he felt really strongly about was that it was immoral to have lotteries because the people, all the people together win is less than what they have put in to the price they pay to play.
Right,
so he
yeah.
wanted to explain it really well. But what I wanted to get to is that his background theory of the world was actually that this is a deterministic world. So if you would know all the positions and the velocities of the particles at one point in time, he believed that the laws of physics can predict any state of the world at any later point in time, as well as retrodict for any past state of the world.
Okay.
So it's quite curious if you contrast probability theory with the fate or it being predetermined or something like that. It's quite curious that the same person who had what is called the demon of Laplace, so the idea that there could be like the super intelligence who can actually calculate and predict everything with perfect accuracy, is the same person who wrote not just this one academic treatise, but also this popular account of probability theory and brought together everything that was known at that point in time. It seems like it doesn't match, right? If he is really strongly convinced that, the world is deterministic, why would he need a probability theory?
Mm.
And the reason why he thought we need it, and it's really useful, is that we simply aren't this demon, this super intelligent being that can do the prediction. We are limited beings. We have limited knowledge of how the world is now. And even if we would be given somehow the full description, we couldn't compute it faster than the world actually runs, so to speak, faster than the events in the future will actually happen.
Right, right.
So even if you would have like a view where it was God who had put in place these deterministic rules, it would still make sense to use probability.
Mm.
Of course, in that worldview of Laplace, if you are doing the I Ching, it seems only to you that the way that these sticks fall is a random event.
Mm.
What is actually going on is that if you would take into account exactly the position, the angles, how you hold them in your hands before you throw them, you could compute it.
Mm.
It's just that we are A, not able to perceive exactly how they are positioned, and B, not that good in being able to predict it in real time before they land.
Yeah.
So it would also be sort of encoded in the universe what the result will be. So maybe there could be a super being sending you messages.
So in that way, there is no real probability. Our probability is just the fact that we can't work things out well enough.
Yeah.
It's our best guess.
Yeah. Mm. So that is why, because now you say there is no real probability, that is why philosophers have sort of suggested maybe we need two different words. Like, they suggested maybe we should use the word chance for things happening in the world that are really not determined. And maybe there is no chance, if we believe Laplace, there is no chance, but we still need probability. And then probability would be reserved for us. So either it's because there are chances in the world, but even if they're not, because we are limited beings, we still need probability either way.
Or so, you can get away from the word probability altogether.
Oh,
and
yeah.
for that epistemic, for that measure of our ignorance, you can call that credences or degrees of belief,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
Right. And so, what's drawn you into the probability? What's really got you hooked into into it for you?
Well, I remember, like, when I was taught probability theory in school, it was kind of weird. Like, you had mathematics, and yeah, you had a lot of things about integrals, and then there was like this disconnected part. It was kind of easy. I mean, it was just counting, basically. But also a bit strange because it was called probability and it has all these connotations, obviously. But I think my teacher mentioned something. And I remember even writing like a short science fiction story about this one word. And I think it only happened once in all mathematics, all the years, that I wrote a fantasy story or about a topic like that.
Yeah.
And I think what she said was, it was something about an impossible event. So she said, like, if you can toss a coin, it can land either heads or tails. And if you're going to model it like that, then these are the only possibilities, those two. But then you could ask about what will happen if it falls like right on the edge.
Mm.
And because that is not in the model, you call it the impossible event.
Right.
And then I wrote a story about a person who was trying, or like struggling to learn about probability theory, and he was trying to do some small experiments, but they all failed because they all ended in like these impossible events. Mm. So like the thing exploded, or the thing landed on the edge, or I don't know the third example. And that is actually the topic that came back to me years later. Like, I wasn't thinking about it all the time. I studied physics. There was some probability there, but again, not very exciting, like not conceptually very challenging. It was just mathematics, like something else. But then at some point I read a paper, and there was this one footnote that was related to an infinite lottery. And there it seemed it had the same flavor, like with these impossible events or something with probability zero.
Right.
And that sort of made me even switch fields. So I wanted to do a lot of philosophy of probability after that.
Let me just interrupt here and say, you know, if anybody's out there listening and watching, you know, what are the chances of that? But if anybody's out there, you know, be sure to post a question or a comment. Oh, good. Who's out there?
Okay.
Let's do shout outs.
Yeah.
What? Yeah.
Yeah.
Ask us what horses to bet on. No.
I don't know.
But Sylvia, so good. So you've brought us to the infinite lottery. Tell us all about the infinite lottery.
Yeah, so we have sort of an ongoing debate on that. So this is where it's going to be tricky. So you have to separate us if we now get to come at it.
Oh, okay.
So obviously when you have like a lottery with many, many, many tickets or many, many combinations, and you only have like one combination that you bet on or one ticket, the probability that you're going to win is very small. That's like a normal lottery, right?
Yeah.
And some people would even argue that it's okay for you to believe that you will not win. So that's something that philosophers are interested in, whether that's okay.
Okay.
But now you could also
go back to that, right?
Oh.
So, right, it's okay for you to believe that you will not win. So you're saying something different there from just knowing that the chances are very slim, or giving very small credence to the event that you
yeah.
win, right? So when you talk about belief, that's different from probabilities, right? Why?
Yeah, because when I use the word that way, I'm not saying degree of belief anymore. So when I say you believe it, it's you believe it or not. So you have to choose between the two. And many people find it plausible that it's okay if the probability is very small to say like, okay, that means you believe that it will not happen.
Okay.
That can get you into trouble. But that's another debate on the infinite lottery, although it's a bit similar. So the next question you can ask is, okay, so if these probabilities become, the lottery become very large, the probabilities become smaller, what happens like in the limit? Like if you have literally an infinite lottery and you have one ticket.
So, right, so by an infinite lottery you mean there are infinitely many tickets,
yes.
right? And you sort of imagine somebody drawing a ticket from an infinite bucket.
Okay.
And they're just going to draw one ticket. You can think of it like each ticket has a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,
yeah.
right? Goes on forever and ever.
Yeah.
Now, and you've got one ticket, what's your number?
It's 900,706.
Right.
Oh, there are infinitely many tickets that have a larger number. So it seems already a bit implausible that you will win. Such a low number.
Yeah.
It's such a low number.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And yet, is there a chance that I could win?
That's the question.
Debate.
Yeah.
Oh,
like, is it now all of a sudden an impossible event that you will win just because there are infinitely many others?
Yeah.
Or should you emphasize the fact that, well, it's not like you don't have a ticket. I mean, you have a ticket.
I have a ticket.
So I very strongly had the intuition I have a chance.
Yeah.
Even if it's like this very, very, very small thing.
Yeah. And that feels good, doesn't it, to have that chance? It does, you know, you go, oh.
Yeah.
A chance.
If you have it, if you, I would pay nothing for it. Literally, I wouldn't pay. There is no amount of money small enough to buy it. But if you would give it to me for free, it seems crazy to throw it out before I know if I've won.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
So there seems to be a difference between not having a ticket, in which case it's clear you have probability zero of winning, and having this one ticket, even though. Well, I mean, I wouldn't bet on winning, not even the smallest amount.
No.
But it's still qualitatively different from having no chance at all.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
I think we should explain that, like, in standard modern probability theory, there are lots of cases where we have an infinitely large field of possible outcomes, right? an infinitely large space of possible outcomes. And the standard thing that we do normally is we assign probability zero to each of those infinitely many possible outcomes. Right? So so go back to the dartboard, and let's assume that the dart has a well-defined center, and there's an exact point on the dartboard that that dart strikes, right?
Yeah.
Well, so each point that the dart might land on, you might say has some probability of being the dart, the spot that the dart does land on.
Yes.
But if you give those exact points any non-zero real value, right? Like say probability, you know, 0.0001.
Yeah.
Then as soon as you get you know, a large enough number of those points together, the probability is going to add up to something larger than one, which doesn't make sense in modern probability theory. The one is the largest probability you can have. So instead what we do is we say, okay, each one of those points has probability zero, yeah, even though they're not strictly impossible. Just like with the infinite lottery, you know, it's not that it's impossible for you to win. Mm. It's just that it's so, so very unlikely that we can't even give it a number that's, you know, we can't even give it a real number anyway. Right. We can't give it a number that's one of the normal numbers that we're used to. There might be another way to do it.
Hmm.
Yeah, so basically that was the quest, like, that, then it's called an infinitesimal probability. Like, can you sneak in some numbers, like, between zero, but smaller than any positive other number?
Okay.
And can you sneak in new numbers there?
Yeah.
To represent this very, very small, like, one divided by infinity, that kind of number.
Yeah. Like, so you might think of it like, you can think of fractions like 1/2, 1/4, 1/8, 1/16,
yeah,
and all of those are positive numbers. And if you keep going 1/32, they get closer and closer to zero.
Yeah,
but they never quite reach zero. And then you want to ask, is it possible we can squeeze in another number, or maybe lots of other numbers, in between zero and all those other positive numbers, so that it's smaller than any positive real number and yet larger than zero? It's a different kind of number system. It's not what we usually use.
Okay. And what's the consent? Is there any consensus on this at all?
I believe it makes sense to do this.
Yeah. I think it makes sense to an extent as well, but there are problems that come out of it. That's all.
And you agree.
There are complications.
There are problems.
We agree that there are problems.
So there's no rational reason for the feeling that you get when you've got a ticket going, I might just be in with a chance.
Is
there
agree
a number
with that.
For I might just be in with a chance? What's the number for that?
Well, you
that
know,
would be a great number.
I think.
No,
I think Sylvia would say it's one of these infinitely small numbers.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, what you could say instead, and what I might be more inclined to say is, well, it's not a number. It's just a bare possibility. It's possible you could win.
Yeah.
But there isn't a number that we can give to that.
Why can't you have a number for it though?
Well. The problem.
Why aren't you allowed to have a number for that? I'm just thinking, you know, you're allowed for lots of different numbers. Why couldn't you have a little
basically
number?
Basically because you run out of the numbers to represent all the finite lotteries. Like there are, that is also almost paradoxical. There are infinitely many finite lotteries.
Okay.
Like you have one that has only one ticket, one that has two tickets, there are three tickets, there's four tickets. There are infinitely many lotteries, so like infinitely many possible sizes, which are all finite lotteries, and you already need all of the real numbers to represent the distinctions among those, so you have run out of numbers. So then the question is, am I allowed, as I am inclined to say I would, to add new numbers, to make them up and find a system of dealing with them consistently?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't literally make them up. I looked at the literature and I found some suggestions for doing this.
Sure.
Or should we go with what Matt says and says, well, yeah, you have run out of numbers. It's true that you have a chance, but it's not a number. So that is basically...
You've got a chance, but I'm not going to... I'm not going to give it a label.
The problem that comes up when you start giving things infinitely small probabilities, one of the problems that comes up is that in order to do that, in order to assign probabilities to all of these infinitely unlikely events, you need some very fancy mathematics, and it's the mathematics is to put it a certain way. Just to construct this probability, this sort of probability assignment where you give each ticket a probability, just to construct these sorts of probabilities, you need these sorts of functions that we can't even write down. So we have axioms that enable us to prove that such things exist in a kind of ideal mathematical world, but they're so complicated that you can't write them down.
But on the other hand, you could say, I mean, people have said similar things about things we now don't worry about. Like, suppose you have like a tile, it's a rectangle or a square actually, and there is a circle in it, and now you are a very drunk darts player, and you ask about what is the probability that you're going to hit within the circle rather than in the square. And that will use the number pi in it, so an irrational number. And the decimal expansion of pi goes on into infinity. And actually, people have used this to claim that that is not a real number. Like, not real in like how we now use the word real numbers. But before that, it was thought that only like things you can write as a fraction are numbers. And there's other things that are bizarre things because you can't write it down, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can make up a symbol and say pi, but you can't give me all the decimals of pi.
Mm.
And it seems like it has a similar flavor, although I agree it's even worse with these infinitesimals.
Yeah, that's right. It's so even worse because with pi, with pi, you can write down a method for approximating pi as accurately as you want to. So if you want to compute, if you want to compute the first, 100 digits of pi, you can write down a computer program or a set of instructions that tells you how to do that. Whereas with these sort of probability assignments, we can't even write down an effective description, or at least as far as I know, we can't.
Mm-hmm.
We can't write down any effective description of how to construct a probability function that makes something like an infinite lottery work. We just have this sort of mathematical idea that it's possible, that it could exist out there.
But on the other hand, like with pi, you can just introduce a symbol and use it like for bookkeeping principles. And then the mathematics just tells you that what you're doing is not going to end up being inconsistent. So you're not going to end up in one of those nightmare paradoxes.
Uh-huh.
So you can just do that and things will be okay, even though you cannot really, like with pi, say what are the decimals or anything like that, because it doesn't have that.
Right.
Now we are coming to the murkier side.
The murky stuff.
The murky side of probability.
This is the face that Tim makes when we talk about maths.
Oh, it's at infinity. It's when you get to infinity that I always kind of glaze over, because I do have trouble getting my head around that.
Yeah, well, you might ask, like, why even bother? Why should we talk about infinite lotteries?
But why?
Because it's fun?
Yeah, because it's fun. It's mathematical fun. But what I'm kind of interested in, having talked about that sort of dichotomy about the way that maths really deconstructs things in a very, very sensible, rational, logical way that kind of sometimes undermines the more romantic side of things in some respects. I'm kind of interested in not being able to quantifying that feeling, because it is interesting. There's a definite feeling I get. I mean, I don't do the lottery very often. Now and again, I've got a couple of quid in my pocket. I think, what the hell? I'll do the lottery. I know the odds are stacked against me. I don't care. And I get it. And I'm excited for a bit. And I get that thing, and we put it on the mantelpiece, and we go, right, we'll watch the results, and the results come up, and of course... Nothing, of course.
It's always disappointing,
course,
isn't it?
And but it's quite good fun to hope for a little bit.
Especially if you get the first two or three numbers, then you're like, come on.
Yeah, and I've never even got that far, and I'm never, ever surprised. And of course go, well, of course, you were stupid wasting that 2 quid.
But there's
a feeling.
I think Sylvia said something earlier in an email that there's an argument that playing lottery might be rational.
Yeah, so the traditional approach, like I said, Laplace would say like it's irrational. So that's the most common view, I think.
Just have a little taste of this.
So it has been called like a tax on people who are bad at probability theory. That's what a lottery is. That has been the view, because if you look at how much people in total can win, it's less than what in total they have put in.
Yeah.
So that's, in that sense,
so unrational. So by a kind of like utility theory conception, the overall utility is bad because someone has gained and some other people have lost, but on the whole...
The people who organize the lottery are sure that they will win something,
yeah,
and all the others on average will lose. Even though there is this one person who will win money, it is less than what all the people together have put in.
Yeah.
So that's like unfair in that sense. But there is another way of looking at it. And it's like, look, we all have insurance, right? And that doesn't seem irrational, even though the insurance company also makes money.
Mm.
So maybe a lottery can be viewed as like an inverse insurance. Like, if I can spare the money, like a lottery ticket, the price is really small. So yeah. I will not be hungry for a day because I bought it. So I lose so very little, it doesn't really influence my life. But if I would be the lucky one who is winning, then it would have a very big, probably positive effect on me. So that suggests that maybe it is rational to play on the lottery.
Mm. Well, I've always felt that way, but why do you call it inverse insurance?
Yeah, because in the case of insurance, you are like putting in some money for the case that you are going to lose a lot. So at least if you don't have the insurance, there are cases in which, for instance, your house burns down, so you lose a lot. Mm-hmm. And now putting in a little bit of money protects you for that case, because then you will get some money to buy new stuff. Even though on average people put in a bit more than what is actually given to people whose house actually burned down, that doesn't seem to be so unreasonable, because this company has to do all that administration.
It's like a bet on something bad happening.
Yes, exactly.
It's a bet on something good happening.
Yes, exactly. So you could look at it like that. And even if there are some losses in the sense that somebody is making money for sure, so it is always better to be either the insurance agent or the one organizing the lottery. Even though that is the case, it doesn't seem so irrational from that perspective. But what the third part is, like, who are the people actually gaining the most or dreaming the most of winning the lottery? Mm. I guess those are the people that are the poorest, right? Mm. And it's not that clear that for them, like, part of my argument was that, well, I will not be hungry for a day if I pay a lottery ticket. For the poorest people, it has the largest effect on their budget if they do buy lottery tickets and so on. So another way of, the third way of looking at it, so the first one was, it's a tax on being stupid, basically, on being not able to compute the probability properly.
Mm-hmm.
The third view is that it's a tax on the poor,
yeah.
Because those are, relatively speaking, although the ticket price is the same, relatively speaking, they pay more, like more percentage-wise.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I would say that even like these legal national lotteries are in a way immoral,
yeah,
because
there
is this, this factor that is not the same for everybody.
So not necessarily irrational for everyone, but immoral on the whole because of the way that they take advantage of people.
Yeah.
But now there's also, there's another argument that occurs to me about this sort of lottery insurance parallel, which is, well, look, the reason why we buy insurance is to reduce risk. And that has an intrinsic value because it enables us to plan. And, we know that we can plan on doing something in a year because if the house burns down, the insurance will pay for it.
Yeah.
But whereas playing the lottery actually sort of increases your risk in a sense. It increases your uncertainty about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Mm. And so some people would say that that's bad to introduce uncertainty into your own life.
Yeah, that could be, actually. It's not so clear that on the long term, it doesn't seem to be the case that people become happier because they won the lottery. Mm. So
that's
it also
true.
Takes adjusting. And
that's really sad when you find out people won the lottery and they're unhappy and they've already spent all the money. And
exactly.
God.
So that's why I don't play the lottery, in case that wasn't clear.
Yeah.
So you
don't. No, and it is. Okay. It is, exactly. You know, and that's a phrase that I've often heard, is it's a tax on the poor.
Yeah.
And it is, and it is.
And the stupid.
There is an immoral, an immorality about it. But there's also, it's not only, it's a tax on, I don't know, as I said before, there's a little kick of excitement that you get when you take that plunge.
And well, then you're getting your money's worth,
it's not coming from a... It's coming from an irrational place, but not necessarily a stupid place, I think.
But that's true of sports as well, unless you think, the kick of watching sports is stupid.
Yeah.
It's like...
It's like you see people spend all day at the bookies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Scrunching up the tickets.
Yeah. But then we're also into that other thing about sort of, the adrenaline kick, aren't you? And that's a sort of an addiction for a lot of people.
Mm.
Oh,
yeah.
We've got a visitor here from...
What are the chances?
What are the chances?
Yeah.
live at the LSE.
That's true. There's also the addiction element of gambling, which is very, you know, which makes it even more exploitative.
Yeah, and that makes the whole discussion of probability even more complicated because there are all these psychological factors. So some people are like risk averse, and maybe I am risk averse because that could be. So it could be that it's not just for rational reasons that I don't play the lottery. It's just that I wouldn't be so happy if something's changing all of a sudden in my life, even if it were for the better, because I would win some money.
Yeah.
It's not that clear that I would be a happier person because I like to be like have a moderate life and things being predictable. So there is this psychological factor of being risk averse, but on the other hand, there is a psychological factor that some people have that they are being attracted to risk and that they will be willing to have some net losses because of this.
Yeah.
So there is this additional pleasure that they get out of it that you don't compute if you only look at the money that they are going to win or invest.
And that predictability of life as well, I mean, that falls in with the understanding of probability as well, I suppose, in a way, doesn't it?
I think that was like, after that, the principles of probability theory were developed. It applied to these games of chances, but that's not like real life. That's like, as you say, maybe a pleasurable evening playing game, right? It's not life.
Was it Bernoulli, I think, that was supposed to be a notorious gambler and really started developing the theory of probability specifically for the purpose of gambling?
Yeah, and also the original reason why Pascal and de Fermat wrote about it was because they were promoted or were asked by Chevalier de Meret. So he was this gambler who also frequented the salons, and he asked it to the mathematicians, like, apparently he had some really clear and fine-tuned intuitions already about how probable it was to have certain combinations, but he had like one specific question, like, is this really more probable than this other combination? And it turned out to be really close if you can do the computation, but nobody could. And it was for this reason that probability theory was developed for the first time.
Oh.
But it took another step to then apply it really to life. And for instance, there was a Belgian, Kittelet, who looked at the length of people and also the lifetime, the lifespan.
So what do you mean the length of people?
Like the height. Like the height. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, but I was already planning to say the length of
good.
The life.
Length is another thing, but okay.
Yeah, sorry. So the height of people, so the physical dimensions, but also the lifespans. Yeah. And he saw that there was this neat statistical distribution. Like, it's like this bell curve. Like, most people have, like, average height or lifespan, and then there are fewer people who deviate from it, and very few people who are very short or very long or live very shortly or very long.
Oh.
But that's yet another step, like applying it to people's life or people's properties.
But that was him. So he discovered this bell curve, but again...
Well, it was discovered, but not in the context of people. So the surprise was that there, again, is the same curve.
Aha.
Yeah.
But is that just like a coincidence?
That he discovered it?
No,
the
bell curve,
curve.
Just a coincidence.
Well, no, there are some. It makes sense, right?
Oh,
like
okay.
If you have like from the modern perspective, there's genetics, so there are all kind of programs, so to speak, like metaphorically running, and then there are some variation in how much you are being fed or how well you are, and that makes sense that there is this spread. But
yeah, there's like an underlying because okay, so suppose you roll two die, right? What's the most likely sum that you're going to get?
If seven.
Yeah, it's seven, right? It's much more likely to get a seven than a two, right? Because that would mean that both dice have to come up exactly one.
Yeah.
Whereas a seven, there's lots of different ways to get a seven. Well, people's height is largely determined by genes, and there might be, say, two or three or five different sort of genes that determine your height.
Mm.
And so when you consider like random distributions of those genes, well, then chances are they're going to cancel out in such a way that you end up sort of average height.
Yeah.
But if you happen to have all the tall genes, then you're going to be really tall.
Mm. And then there's environmental factors, but it's the same story, basically.
Yeah.
Like, maybe you will be ill for a time, but well-fed, and it's unlikely that you will be not well-fed and ill, and everything goes wrong, basically. So, yeah.
So the correlation is an understandable scientific correlation between those things. But how was he... So, in that understanding, how was he applying probability? You just might have to repeat what you just said because I just went over my head. So, what was that? How did that fit in with probability theory?
So basically you can look at the distribution and that's just counting people, but then you can sort of ask, like, if I would pick a random person from the street, what is the probability that this person is larger than, say, a meter, 70 centimeter?
Yeah.
And then you can look at the distribution of the people you have already measured, and then you sort of assume that from the people you are drawing someone from, it's like a random choice from this distribution. But obviously you are making assumptions, because it could be that if you measured the previous generation, it is actually the case that people on average get a bit have a longer height, larger height if they're from the next generation, because there is this progress in food and central heating and so on. So there, once you are going to measure things, there is always this additional assumption. It's not just mathematics anymore. So you could be wrong in what kind of model you're using there. But you do expect that whatever the average value is, that could go up in time, or it could go down again, but you still expect there are these explanations for why it should be, the distribution should be like a bell shape.
Okay. And what about the future of probability?
The future?
In terms of its evolution of the probability theory, because obviously you're kind of pushing about, you know, you're pushing in the boundaries, you're building mathematical models.
Sylvie's on the cutting edge,
right? So where are we cutting? Where are we going with probability theory and its application in, you know, in future science and maths?
Well, I think the last decade saw we haven't touched on that really, but saw a lot of applications of a theorem that was developed already long before Laplace. Laplace rediscovered it and explained it really well, but still it took a long time for us to understand what it really means. And in the last decades, it has had many applications. The name of it is Bayes' theorem. And basically, it's about what you have to do if you have a certain probability distribution and now you learn something new. Like, you use all the knowledge you had to assign your probabilities, but now all of a sudden, for instance, in science, you do experience to learn things. And now you have this probability distribution and this new information, like, how does that match together? That was figured out, but sort of how to do that and how to apply that in all kind of situations and how general that rule, that Bayes' theorem is, has only been realized relatively recently. And it can be used for all kind of things. Like, it's used, for instance, in these spam filters. Like, given certain words that appear in the title of an email or the body of the email, maybe you know more about it than
not
I do.
Really,
actually.
No.
That's really
how
it is.
No, I don't know about the application of Bayes' theorem and this stuff.
Okay. So basically, you wanna figure out now, these words are in there, and you have like a corpus, like you know, you have classified by hand, so to speak, certain emails. You know that in the spammy ones, those words occurred a lot, and in the non-spammy ones, it's like an other average word cloud, so to speak.
Yeah.
And now you are going to match on, like, using that old information to sort of guess, what is this email? Is it spam or not?
Right.
So you try to use that information based on probabilities.
So it feeds into sort of AI, really, does it?
For instance, but many other things. Also, like medical imaging software, all these things with error correcting codes, and many, many applications.
Okay.
Yeah. And anything where you learn things, but all of science is like that. You do experiments and then you have to update your information somehow. And it's like this one rule that can cover them all.
But interesting that probability in itself is only it feels like it's only really quite recently coming into its own in lots of ways. I mean, yes, probability theory has been around, but the kind of understanding and the application of it is only just getting
developed. I think it can, one way of looking at it is that it can be like this unifying factor across all of the sciences, that all, like, the social sciences, I already talked a bit about humans, but also all informatics, also all the natural sciences, they all use probability, but sometimes it seems to refer to something like in the world, like the chances, things not being determined, and sometimes it is seemingly referring only to our lack of information of what is really going on.
Right.
But now we have like this unifying framework where we say that, well, You can always use probabilities, no matter whether what is going on in the world is like determined or not.
Mm.
So that is like the power of it. Like from that perspective, you can treat all the cases with just one theory, which has very few axioms and is actually quite easy to learn. If we would have 3 hours, I could explain all the axioms and you are ready to go. You can do all the applications.
Oh, and it's very interesting because we have this one standard theory of probability, right? And
yes.
For a long time in the 20th century in particular, philosophers have argued about, well, what is probability? Is it just our degrees of belief, or is it something real in the world? And now there are like many different interpretations of what probability is. But regardless, the same mathematical theory seems to be perfectly adequate to describe our degrees of belief, as well as physical propensities. You know, what is the real tendency of this die to turn up 6, or what is the real tendency for a quantum experiment to come out with a certain result? And it's very interesting that we have all this. We have this one mathematical structure that can be used to characterize beliefs, degrees of beliefs, how the world behaves, as well as, you know, other kinds of measures.
Super versatile.
Yeah, and that is maybe also why even wilder ideas, or maybe like niche topics like infinitesimal probabilities that I'm interested in, like they seem worthwhile to explore, because even if the probability is low that it will add something, if it does, it can have a major effect, right? Because it could clarify many things.
Yeah.
Obviously, the probability is small. I don't claim that I have the next new big thing. But that is why I think many people are attracted to work on like edges of fine-tuning certain things in probability theory, because if it does catch on and it does help us to think more clearly, it helps us in all the cases at once. So it is worthwhile, I think, to explore it, even if it's only to rule out this one option, so being very Popperian, falsification. Cool. Even if it's just to rule this option out, then nobody else has to waste time.
Well, I would like to rule out this wine, actually.
Okay.
Would you like to have a little one more drop before we say goodbye?
And okay.
Because
thank
we
you.
Could, in all probability, talk about this all night, but we have to...
That's all right, I didn't want to. No, I'm just...
I got a bit distracted there. Trying to pour wine and talk at the same time is a bit of a challenge. Yeah, yeah. You can have a sip later. But listen, we'd just like to thank you very much for coming on and just...
Thank you, Sylvia.
...expanding
for
our minds.
Me. That's nice.
Because that's what it's all about, really, here. So I'd just like, maybe just clink glasses.
Okay. Cheers.
And...
Gesundheit.
Yeah.
Gesundheit.
And...
yeah, I'm not quite reaching you.
Gesundheit. Mm. And as they used to say when I was growing up in my fatalistic, superstitious household... When your number's up, it's up. Well, our number's up, and there's nothing you can do about it. So, our number's up tonight, but thanks very much. And I think it's time to...
I'll do the air guitar.
Play out, do air guitar.
Air guitar.
Okay.
Best instrument. 1, 2, 3. Oh.